to invite anyone who has any questions or comments or would like to disagree. I really like it when people disagree or tell me I've got it all wrong. It doesn't happen very often in Thailand. People are too afraid to. Yes.
In many religions, I think, there is beliefs of heaven and hell, a better place, a worse place after someone's time on earth, so to speak. And as well as in Buddhism, there seems to be a continuity of a soul, if I'm getting it right. Please correct me if I'm wrong. But it seems overall that there is similarities in that through all religions, would you say?
Yes. First, it's an interesting topic, one which even in Buddhist communities is somewhat controversial, I'd say. let's start with the question, does Buddhism actually teach about heaven and hell? Because there was a modern Western influenced movement within the Buddhist tradition to say that it's all kind of symbolic language, and we're really talking about mental states, and heaven and hell are states of happiness and pain in the human heart, and that they are not actually realms of heaven and hell. So I would argue against that. And there is one key discourse in which the Buddha is walking in a forest with his students, and he picks up a handful of leaves. You may have heard of this. And he asks the students, which is more, the leaves in my hand or the leaves in the forest? And of course, I think students are probably happy to have such an easy question to answer. They say, obviously, the leaves in the forest exceed the leaves in your hand. And the Buddha said, the leaves in the forest are like all the things that a Buddha knows. And the leaves in my hand are equivalent to all the things the Buddha teaches. So I don't teach you everything that I know, but I teach you what you need to know for this path of liberation. And so where can we find this handful of leaves? Well, this is the recorded teachings in all the discourses. And what we can observe in those teachings is the Buddha does refer to other realms, heaven and hell realms, on many occasions. So we can conclude from that the Buddha, of all the things that the Buddha knew about, heaven and hell was one. Other realms of existence. Not only did he know about these realms, but he felt of those things that he had knowledge, it was also important to share that with people on this path of education or path of liberation. Now, there is also a view sometimes out of that some of the Buddha's teachings were concessions to the prevailing religious beliefs of people in India at that time, and that this would be one of them. And the counter argument to that is that that view of the Buddha is somewhat demeaning. It's the idea that the Buddha would actually misrepresent the truth in order to gain converts or popularity for his religion, which is, we would say is not possible. The Buddha wouldn't do that. And also that there was no consensus in Indian society at that time on the existence of other realms of being. There were various materialist sects and various sects that denied anything except the present life, and not dissimilar at all to modern materialist views. So having said that, there are a few more points that need to be made. One is that the major distinction between the Buddhist teachings on heaven realms and hell realms and their presentation in most of the theistic or monotheistic religious systems is that they're not considered to be permanent. They are impermanent. They are, by human standards, require people who enter on these realms to defer a very long time by human standard. But nevertheless, when the karma responsible for them being born in such a realm expires, then they leave that realm and are reborn. Now, this does bear directly on the path to liberation, in that the Buddha's teaching is that aspiration for rebirth in a heaven realm is reasonable, rational, legitimate aspiration, but that it's still a flawed aspiration, an imperfect aspiration, because heaven realms are not permanent, and that sooner or later you'd have to leave it. So in the big picture of things, over millions and millions of lifetimes, it's, you know, like going on holiday in a 5-star resort for a while. You know, that's, you know, at the end of that, you've still got all this work you have to get done. So it's not ultimately the wisest goal. Now, the other really important question is, if Buddhism teaches anatta, or not self, then how can it square that with the teaching of rebirth? And surely there must be a soul for the soul to be reborn in another realm. So the response to that is, well, before you can answer that question, you have to be looking at what you can experience and prove for yourself is your life right now. So can you find a soul in your body and mind right now? What do you mean when you say soul anyway? So you have these very detailed analysis in Buddhist tradition. You say, okay, is the soul the same thing as your body? Or is it separate from your body? Or is there some connection between the soul and your body? If your soul is your body, if you say you lost your arm in an accident, is the soul affected by that? Or if you, or say a bit more profound, if you had your heart, you had a heart transplant, does that affect your soul? Or how does your soul relate to feelings? Happy feeling, unhappy feeling, is it one and the same thing? Does the soul possess these feelings? Is the soul identified with these feelings? Is the soul conditioned by these feelings? What about perception? What about thought? What about emotion? What about sense consciousness? So this is the Buddhist analysis of life as you can know it and can experience it right now. And what the Buddha is saying is, you can't find it, can you? And where is it? So the idea is we create this idea of self and project it, or assume that it's there or it's standing behind experience. But when the mind has been purified by meditation, it's able to disprove that as a mistaken assumption. Okay, now if we take that as a working hypothesis, well then, what is reborn? And the Buddhist view is that, a phrase I used the other day, there are no nouns. Okay, so there's nothing which is an object acting upon objects or being acted upon objects. They're a stream. Life is a stream. The mind or the heart is a stream. And so this is the transformation of a stream. Now, the one analogy that might clarify this way of looking at life is, if you can imagine two candles, and you light a candle, and you say, what is the candle flame? Is it a thing? To the eye, we say there's a candle flame, there is a thing called a candle flame, but actually, you know, even with high school chemistry qualifications, we're aware that the flame is actually the manifestation of a chemical reaction. You have heat, you have a candle, the candle wick, oxygen, all those things in the correct proportions and in the right relationship produce a flame. And that flame will manifest as long as the candle is still there and there's still wick. Now let's say that as one candle burns out, and you were, from that flickering flame, you were to light a second candle. Now it wouldn't be correct to say that this candle, or this flame, was reborn, or it's the same flame that was in the first candle is now in the second candle. But nevertheless, there has been a transmission. There is a continuity. There is a relationship. So this is an analogy to the understanding of what takes place in rebirth. There is a stream, and the vessel for that stream disappears, and a new vessel appropriate to this stream will appear in its stead. And so in Buddhist view, then the mental state, the mental habits, the amounts of kindness and generosity and wisdom and so on in the human heart will determine the experience in the next lifetime. So if a mind is very harsh and cruel and selfish and so on, then it will seek to be reborn, if to use that conventional language, in a vessel which allows those energies to manifest. If the mind is kind and bright and clear and calm and gentle, then it will seek a vessel which will express those virtues. So another way of saying that, there is rebirth in lower realms or higher realms, heavens or hell, depending upon the prevailing states of mind, which is a function also of action, of karma, in other words, and the inner education or lack of inner education of the being. That's sort of rebirth in a nutshell. Yeah.
This kind of goes along the line of what you were talking about, doubt. And what I found with my own practice, there are certain things I can experience in my life that I can verify as true, like the nature of suffering and cessation of suffering through mindfulness and practicing compassion and other things like that. But when it comes to concepts like rebirth and karma and different realms of existence, there's no way that I know that I can experience that. So is the suggestion to blindly believe in that? Because to me, that's almost counter to what, at least my understanding of what Buddha taught.
Yeah, that's kind of a loaded question. If you ask a Buddhist monk, you know, whether I'm teaching you to blindly believe in something, I'm going to say no straight away, without a doubt. But let me expand. I have an analogy. Let's say you were born, grew up in a state like, I don't know, Iowa or somewhere where it's completely flat. And from the moment of your birth, you've never seen a landform which is more than a sort of a bump in the landscape. And then, I don't know, like the Wizard of Oz, you're blown away and you find yourself in a strange land. But some kind person gives you a map, big map, and a little X saying, you are here. And so you open the map and you start walking along, and you're not really sure, you know, who was this guy? You know, is this a reliable map or not? So you look to the left and you look to your right, and you look in your map and see whether the things that you can see are accurately represented on this map. So you're walking along for a few hours, and every single feature that you can see right here and now is accurately represented on the map. So after a certain period of time, you're going to conclude this is a really good map. At least I've got a good map. Now let's say you feel like a rest, you sit down on a rock, you open up the map, and then you look ahead, and you see way over here, there are things called mountains. What's a mountain? No idea. And then it says this mountain is like 5,000 meters and the peak is 5,000 meters above sea level. And everything in you cries out, that's impossible. I know you've only ever seen like a bump in the landscape 100 feet high. Your logic tells you, come on, that's just unbelievable. You can't visualize it. What would it be like, a mountain? Your imagination can't reach that because you don't have anything to compare it to. So you think, no. But then something else inside you says, is it likely that all those parts of the map which I have verified have all been absolutely accurate, and yet this part of the map in this corner is completely inaccurate, given that it's one map and it seems to have been written by one person? So you have this kind of debate, you know, in your mind, and logic comes up here also, and you say, well, it seems it's the same map, same person wrote the map, and that just because I've never experienced, I've never seen a map in my hometown doesn't mean a mountain in my hometown surely doesn't mean that there aren't any in the world. You know, I don't have any grounds to assert that. So the attitude of the Buddhist is not blind faith, but it's taking things on as a working hypothesis. You say, I know that I haven't proved this for myself, and I recognize that, but at the same time, I'm going to take this on as a working hypothesis and see where it leads me. But I'm not going to close my eyes to counter evidence that runs against that. I'm not going to just go for it. I'm going to keep my eyes open. But the guy who wrote this map, he, from what I've seen, he's a really good map maker. So with the Buddhist teachings, as you say, there are certain things that can verify from day one, and the number of things that you can verify increase over the course of time, and after a while you just have this great confidence in the Buddha as a teacher, and that the Buddha is someone who truly knew what he was talking about. So if the Buddha talks about other realms of being and heaven and hell and those things, first thing is, yeah, I don't know. And as a Buddhist, it's completely all right to say you don't know. There's no shame in that at all. Yeah, it's one of the areas Buddhist teachings that I have no direct knowledge of. So someone asks you, oh, you're a Buddhist, you believe in reincarnation. Oh, you're a Buddhist, you believe in this and that. Yeah, I'm a Buddhist, I care for the truth. I don't say I know things that I only believe. I have a belief, a reasoned, rational belief in this, but I acknowledge that I don't actually know. But I'm taking this teaching on as a working hypothesis, because the Buddha suggested that it would be helpful in my practice to do so.
Coming from what seems to be my Western mindset, always trying to find empirical, objective truth. Many of us Westerners are very new to this idea of Buddhist thought. And we have the privilege, or perhaps the difficulty, of dealing with many schools of Buddhism that are coming here into our culture. Some claim a sense of mutual exclusivity on their corner of truth on the market, huh? So maybe you have some words or suggestions or ideas about how we deal with things, as opposed to, let's say, a Theravadan experience, the influence of Mahayana Buddhism, some schools that rely heavily on certain scriptures or sutras, other schools that deny them. How we're attracted to one school or the other. And then even within that, let's say like in a Theravada tradition, as a layman, as a householder who's married with a child, is there any hope for me to experience liberation, or is that only reserved for monastics?
Yeah. Thank you. As you say, sometimes it feels like a blessing and sometimes like a curse to have this spiritual cornucopia stroke supermarket all around, especially in California. One thing that comes to my mind was came to my mind immediately when you were asking the question was that I've often seen scholastics from different traditions arguing, but my own experience meeting with monks of other Buddhist traditions, Mahayana, Vajrayana, and so on, is that if we're all meditators, we all get on like brothers and sisters. So it's in the realm of thought and theory that as my direct experience is monastic, that's really what determines whether we get on or don't get on. In a sense, it's a matter of personality and inclination. I mean, my own journey was one in which I was 18 years old, and I was in McLeod Ganj, the Dalai Lama. It happened I'd contracted hepatitis, so I wasn't a very diligent student. But I had great faith and inspiration in the teachings. But I personally have medical condition, but I have almost zero capacity for visualization. I don't have any pictures or colors in my mind. And to embark on a monastic tradition, which in so many of the meditations are based upon that kind of visualization, it didn't seem that was really going to work for me. And I liked the down-to-earth, practical approach of Theravada Buddhism. So that suited me in that sense. The other criteria that had a lot of weight with me is that I've been in India and seen many gurus and many spiritual teachers, and already by the mid-late 70s, there were a lot of these already scandals, and particularly sexual scandals where charismatic teachers were taking advantage of their female students. And I was very skeptical of any tradition where it said that someone who is a spiritual adept or a great teacher has transcended morality and doesn't have to keep the same rules as everyone else, and you shouldn't judge their behavior in the way that you would judge a normal person's behavior. And I felt I didn't really believe that, but I also felt in terms of creating a sustainable system free of abuse, that wasn't a very good teaching to propound. So what I really liked about Theravada monastic order was that I've been a monk for 35 years. I wear exactly the same robes, quality of robes I did on my first day. And I don't have a special hat or any kind of insignia to say I've been a monk for 35 years. I have to keep every single rule that I kept when I was on my first day as a monk. And even monks like Ajahn Chah and great enlightened masters, they keep every single rule. Not because they need to, but out of a sense of compassion and out of respect for the discipline and the monastic order that the Buddha created. And so there are absolutely no concessions to behavioral norms given to a monk or a nun or anyone simply because they have achieved some spiritual insight or spiritual maturity. So I felt, yeah, this is something I can trust. On a Buddhist monastic education, that teachers will often ask you to do things you don't want to do. And that's a sign of a great teacher. He doesn't just want to be popular. He'll challenge you and push you and maybe make you feel uncomfortable or even be angry with him. But he does that like a doctor would give you medicine you don't want to take. But there are boundaries. He would never ask you to do anything that was unethical or would involve harming yourself or others. So I was attracted to this particular tradition. This is a sense of the trust and its integrity and its standards of conduct. And I think that when we get into a realm of metaphysics and philosophy, most of this is over the head, over our head for sure, particularly when we start. And we're not able to discriminate between different theories of, you know, the relationship between the mind and mental object or something, I don't know. But what I think we can make discriminations on is conduct and behavior and how the teacher relates to students and spiritual communities conduct themselves, particularly in relation to sexual matters, relationship to power relations, relation to money. So coming down to that level, you know, how do these things function, all these really powerful emotional areas, how are they dealt with by both the teacher and the community of his students? And I think that if you have a community which has very good moral and ethical standards, then and it attracts you and you feel there's something really there, give it a try. But you can't know beforehand. But as I mentioned earlier on, give different things a try, and then just generally you think, yeah, this really feels good enough. You know, if you're not looking for the best, absolute best, yeah, this is good enough. I can grow in this, and there's something here that can really, I feel something very, very good happening within me. In the Theravada tradition, the Buddha speaks of four levels of enlightenment. Stream entry is the first, and arahantship is the fourth and final level. It's very difficult, to be frank, for a householder to realize the highest level of enlightenment. But it's also extremely difficult for monks as well, so it's not a sort of an unfair system. But many householders, both male and female, over the past 2,600 years, right up to the present day, have been able to realize stream entry as leading a normal life in the world, raising a family. And it's not an insuperable obstacle. And I think that in many ways, we could say that in the present age, we have householders have many advantages over householders in the past, in the extent that for all of its faults, modern capitalist society gives us choices, lifestyle choices, that people in the past never had. And that, for instance, well, this is not true for everyone, of course, but many people at a certain level of affluence can make choices perhaps to take a job which is less well paid, but which allows us to take periods of retreat or to live a more quiet and peaceful life, more giving us more time to devote to spiritual matters. And if money and status and fame and all these things are not the major considerations in life, these days we have access to teachings which I think any people of any previous generation would be very jealous. You know, you can get in your car and choose between a list of enlightened masters. Who do you want to listen to this morning? And if you don't like him, you can take him out and put someone else in. You know, so you know, there are audio, visual, all kinds of resources available, and householders have access to the best teachings, the most on almost every topic that few monastics would have had in the past. So, you know, at the same time as we're threatened by global warming and as economic downturns and collapses and so on and so forth, and all the pressures of technology and so on, but at the same time, I think householders do have an opportunity to grow and develop in the Dhamma, which is unprecedented.
Hello, Ajahn. First off, thank you for the beautiful teaching. You spoke of, emotion and difficult of dealing with emotion. I think growing up, I don't normally talk about my feeling, and it is something I want to work on. I have a friend who is a therapist that advised me to like seek therapy just to get in touch with my feeling, my emotion, so that I can deal with you know, the difficult in my life. Like, to what extent would you advise for anyone to, you know, seek that path and yeah, to deal with all emotion? Thank you.
Well, it seems there are more kind of schools of therapy than there are schools of Buddhism. So I think it would depend on, you know, the particular kind of therapy as well. And I think that the value, I've never been in therapy and I don't have much knowledge of this, so I'm speaking from a point of relative ignorance here, okay? Seems to me that the value of a therapist is someone who you feel is a good friend and someone who has your best interests in heart, but is someone who is outside of your family and your group of friends, and is someone who has that bit of distance, and someone who's very skilled in understanding how we express ourselves and how we hold things in, and can give us some reflection and some advice for us to be able to see ourselves more clearly. So if you can find a therapist who doesn't have some particular ideas and theories that he wants to you know, sort of brainwash you with or inculcate you with, but is and maybe that's unfair on 99% of therapists anyway, but someone who's like a good friend, or what we call a Kalyana Mitra, and someone who can help you in a way that you feel comfortable and not constrained by, you know, if we often have good friends and like Dhamma friends, but then, you know, your Dhamma friend, maybe he's a friend of your family or, you know, and you're just worried if you open up too much, it gets passed on and it's not private. And so having someone who's sort of outside of all of that can sometimes, I think, be helpful. Nevertheless, I mean, I don't think it's absolutely essential. But I think that many meditators and Asian meditators, particularly, and Asian male meditators, you know, we try to seek to bypass emotion. You know, like we don't want to deal with all that stuff. We're on the fast track to liberation. You know, and that's if we're practicing with sila and samadhi and banya in the way that the Buddha taught us, and not just picking and choosing and leaving some bits out that we find uncomfortable, then I think we do come face to face with emotion and have to learn how to deal with it. And, you know, monastic communities are set up with people who have a shared standard of conduct, shared aspirations, but still, you know, there are all kinds of emotions that come up because it's life and people are still people. But I had a friend who was a monk with me for a number of years, and eventually he left the monkhood and went home, and he came back to visit after he'd been home for a few years. And he said, I just feel so much better now. After I disrobed, I went into therapy and I finally worked out all these feelings, negative feelings and anger towards my mother. And now I get on well with my mother and we spend time together and feel so much better than I did as a monk. So I said, well, all that time you were a monk, you know, how much time and effort did you put into developing the Brahma Viharas, you know, of kindness and compassion, you know, as a major commitment and theme of meditation? And he hadn't really, you know, that the tool, he hadn't actually made use of the tools that the Buddha provided for him to deal with emotion, these are negative emotions. So we have these four positive emotions of loving kindness and compassion and sympathetic joy and equanimity. And these things, we have to work on these things. They don't just arise naturally. And it's not just every now and again, you know, just spread some feelings of loving kindness. But if you have some particular strong, deep-rooted anger or aversion to someone, you have to make the use of the tools on a daily basis over many years. This is not just something you can do in a 10-day metta retreat or something like that. It's lifetime practice. So I think that myself, I believe that the tools are already there in the Eightfold Path. But if for one reason or another you have real resistance and you've never been able to really make use of those tools, then something like therapy can maybe just maybe help out in the short term. Someone at the back.
Hello?
Yeah, my question was, I'm just curious, in this world, there seem to be so many people of, you know, in different conditions, and apparently life easier, and then some people possibly born in conditions that are a little bit more challenging, with a little more struggles. Let's say they're born in like a war-torn area or something. My question was, looking at those different people, what role did karma play into it, or their life play through how they are in this life, I guess? And then my secondary question was, what is Buddha's view on luck?
Luck.
So, two-part question.
Yeah. First of all, the Buddha rejected the view that everything that happens to us in life is because of old karma. And you know, sometimes, you know, the Buddha is not only a sort of a brilliant analyst, but he's also sort of humorous. As he said, you know, one reason can be indigestion, for instance. So, you know, if you have this really awful dream at night, you know, you think that, you know, it's because of past karma, maybe just because you ate something that disagreed with you before you went to bed. And, but we have the idea of old karma and new karma. Okay, so where you're born, in what realm you're born, kind of country you're born, culture you're born, that's conditioned by past karma from previous lives. So keeping the five precepts is the major factor determining rebirth as a human being, for instance. So you've been a very virtuous person in your past lives, otherwise you wouldn't be sitting here today. But the past karma that you have, it's like the raw material you have to work with. So what's really important is what you do with it. So we know people born into very wealthy families, huge inheritance, and they just spend it all on extravagant pleasures and fritter it all away, nothing for the next generation. But we can say that they were very fortunate. They were receiving the fruits of past karma to be reborn in a wealthy and comfortable environment. But they didn't build upon it, didn't make use of that good fortune. And threw it all away. So the good karma is, it's an opportunity. And it's not like a punishment. You know, someone's born into a very difficult situation, it's not like they're being punished. Or someone's born into a very wealthy and comfortable environment, it's not like they're being rewarded. It's just a causal process. So some people are very wary of it, or it's like you're saying that people who are born poor, like they deserve it, you know, serves them right for all the bad things they've done in the past. But that's not the case. And certainly if you think like that, then your heart creating very bad karma for you, which will have future consequences. I have another one of my analogies, and it goes like this. Someone's driving along their car, and they see that someone's driven their car into a tree. So you stop your car, and you go and see what's going on. And you see a body has been flung out of the car, and someone's lying on the ground, and they're injured. And you go to see what's happened and how they are. And within a few feet of the injured person, you get this really strong smell of alcohol. So you know that that person crashed into the tree because they were drunk. Okay? So would you or would anybody say serve them right and get back in your car? And yeah, they know that you shouldn't drink and drive. You know, this is their punishment. I don't think anybody would do that, would they? You know, you'd still call 911 and get help for them. But the recognition that alcohol consumption is a major factor in accidents of every kind is good to know, because you can lay down rules and regulations and so on to minimize that as much as is possible. So just as the recognition that someone is born into an unfortunate circumstance, a war-torn country or whatever, is the result of past karma, then that's just like seeing that someone's had an accident because they're drinking alcohol. The question is, what can you do to help them? What's within your power to prevent this kind of thing happening again, or to minimizing it? So it's not that recognition of karma leads to indifference or to dismissing people and as it's their fault, or it's quite the opposite. You know, we still, as Buddhists or as good human beings, should always try to reduce the amount of suffering we find in the world wherever and whenever we can. So the fact that people who are born in, two people born in similar circumstances and don't always have the same outcomes in their life points to the fact that effort and the way you live your life plays a part, an important part. Being born into a wealthy background is good because it gives you the opportunity to do things like this, to spend your time in wholesome moral activities, to learn about life without having just constant worry and tension about where your next meal is coming from. This is one of the principles that we call Buddhist economics. Interpreter of Buddhist teaching says that in a Buddhist economy, you don't judge the wealth, the success of an economy by the number of millionaires, but by the number of poor people. So if you have a small number of extremely rich people, but a large number of very poor people, then the economy is not a success. So the Buddha said that for anyone to grow spiritually, you have a basic need, what we call the four requisites. You need to be free of anxiety on a day of a need for food, clothing, shelter, and medicines in time of sickness. And that any Buddhist society should try to ensure that everyone has access to those four things. Because if you lack even one of those four things, then Buddhist practice of meditation and so on will never really take root and never be possible. Because the level of anxiety about your physical survival and that of your loved ones is just too strong to allow that. So being in a situation where you don't have that kind of anxiety, that's really good karma. But then it's what you make of it. You know, and that's really the important thing. And so the Buddha said that the greatest luck is to be born as a human being. He said it's great good fortune amongst to be born as a human being. It's great good luck. It's very auspicious. Because this is the realm of existence in which we experience pain and pleasure, happiness and suffering, but not to such an intense level, at least most of us, that we can't learn from it and find ways of dealing with it. And the human realm is the one in which we can most successfully and effectively apply the Buddhist teachings. You know, if you're born in a hell realm or something, there's no way. If you're in a heaven realm, you know, it's just too laid back, it's just too comfortable. But the human realm is just, you know, it's just footy, it's just right for this kind of effort. Sorry, you can ask a question.
Very intrigued by the emotions, because in the five aggregates, form, feeling, perception, mental formation, consciousness, I don't think there's a self, but I certainly feel that there's a self. And the feelings there are talking about sensations. I'm wondering if the Buddha talked about emotions anywhere.
Yes, well, emotion is an interesting word in that. Even amongst psychologists and professional units, there's no real, I don't think, consensus what the word emotion means, even. So we can talk about sort of very charged mental states, but, you know, the lists of emotions vary from authority to authority. So what we call emotions would be included within the fourth khanda, the sankhara khanda, which are all the mental states which are accompanied by volition. So these are volitional mental states. And the teaching which deals with emotions specifically is that of what's called the Brahma Viharas, the cultivation of loving kindness and compassion, sympathetic joy and equanimity. And these are a group because they function in different circumstances. And equanimity is the key one. Often we don't think about equanimity as an emotion, do we? It's like the absence of emotion. But the Buddha is saying it's the stable emotion, and it's the most important of the four. In that, let's say we have a loving kindness and we want to help others to be happy. But then we run into difficulties. We really want to help someone to be happy, but they won't let us. They don't trust us. They don't like us. Or we just don't have the access. Or someone is suffering and we want to help them and they're addicted to something and they just won't listen. They want to go on like, leave me alone. So what happens to someone with these really good intentions and they're frustrated? Without equanimity, you know, you can get hurt and bitter and just write people off or, yeah, I did my best. But equanimity is the wisdom that comes from understanding we are all the inheritors of our karma, and that helping someone is only really possible when there's a maturity of conditions and everything is ready to happen. And that if we're premature, even with the best interests in the world, we won't be able to help somebody. So in the meantime, it's like we go back into neutral gear, as it were. We recognize, yeah, this is they're still working through their karma. Things are not ripe yet. I'm not going to write that person off, but I can't do anything right now. I'm going to be here and ready. When anything changes, that person opens up a little bit, or I find a way that I can help them, then I'll move into a forward gear. But in the meantime, I'm not going to suffer about this and feel bad about it. So these four emotions are developed, and this is an emotional development. So Buddhism not saying, you know, you're peaceful, you renounce emotion and become like a rock, you know, but it's you're cultivating positive emotions. Yeah.
Influence around you of your ability to think and even speak because they don't believe exactly neighbors don't even want to be your neighbors anymore. So traveling and just getting away from that and being able to listen is really a link with something that you can connect with has been helpful. However, there's still my mother and my sister and our friends and family that are very programmed, but that's all they know. And they cannot hear anything.
Mm.
And if you can't even have a conversation. It's I have to go. I'm like, this is so crazy. And I found myself frustrated. And I realized that's a hindrance. And if I even try to push too far, I'm actually going in reverse with my own practice. So neutral and calmness and just compassion for the sake of the practice. It's the only way I can get through it because I can have a conversation.
Also, sympathetic joy. I mean, she must get some happiness from her religious beliefs. But I think it's interesting that, like 10, 20 years ago, there was this sort of very optimistic view with the exponential growth of communications between countries, and we'd all be one big family, one big village, or whatever, all shared values, and these very narrow attachments to ethnicity and to religion, I think these would just sort of fade away. And in fact, the opposites happen. And I think the reason for that is that people live, when most human beings live in a world where everything is changing very rapidly and they have no sense of control, people want something to hold on to. And the most available and satisfying is a belief. So, you know, when you see a belief is a system is a need for people to deal with the suffering produced by a sense of uncontrollable change all around them, then I don't think that's demeaning to recognize that and understand that people are also seeking to deal with their suffering. They've taken it's a different strategy. It's a different, and from a Buddhist point of view, it's not a very successful, ultimately successful strategy. But it's coming from that same place, you know, life's tough, you know, how do you deal with it? Couple of things to say about this. Firstly, the Buddha, when you're questioned by people, Buddha said there are four kinds of questions, four kinds of answers. And when people ask you a question, some questions you should just answer directly. So someone says, are we in the University of the West? And say, yes. Okay, but then let's say someone was to say, is this a good university? A wise person wouldn't say yes or no. You say, well, it depends. What are you talking about? Are you talking about the faculty, the buildings, the student body, or so you have to take the question apart and deal with different aspects of it which are not there in the original question. And the third way of answering a question is with a counter question, which often, if it's skillful enough, can allow people to see themselves and where they're coming from. But the fourth way to answer a question, and this is perhaps the right one here, is don't say anything at all, because whatever you say, it will just make it worse. Where my mother lives in England, there are not so many evangelicals, but a lot of Jehovah's Witnesses. Well, I guess they're evangelicals. And my mother's method, she has a framed photograph of me by the front door. So whenever they knock on the door, she says, this is my son. He's a Buddhist monk. And it tends to work quite well. One more thing is that one question to ask evangelical Christian or anyone with a strong is, what are the things within you that stop you from being the kind of Christian you would like to be? Yeah, are you a perfect Christian? Are you a what are the things within you that prevent you from being what you would like to be as a Christian? And then people will say, yeah, sometimes I lose my temper. I can be very jealous of people around me. I get depressed. I get anxious about things. And then that's where as a Buddhist you can there's a bridge there. You say because this is what Buddhism is about. Buddhism is very directly concerned with how you deal with jealousy, how you deal with anger, and it has a lot of very effective and wise methods of dealing with things that make us suffer and mean that we don't express ourselves and live our lives in the way that we would like to. So if we're on the level of doctrine and there's no connection at all, but in the level what really makes us suffer in life and what we can do about it, then I think that maybe we can talk to people like that.
That's so interesting. Having been raised, I can't even believe I didn't recognize what they're doing now that I'm out of it. And that's incredibly helpful. So thank you. Do you know of any places in the world that lay people, like families, couples, are there any practicing communities that are almost like monastic in nature where if others that are already in your life, they, not a commune, but just a place where like-minded people can live.
Well, the idea of monasteries in my tradition is that you provide that kind of focus for lay meditators, householders, and that living with, within driving distance or walking distance of a monastery, you can go there on a daily basis or with weekends and meet like-minded people and offer service and listening to the Dhamma and meditate. And now these places are starting to spring up, and the monasteries that I know of, particularly the one in Northern California near Ukiah, and one in Columbia River Gorge just outside Portland, which is where I've been visiting. And as they become more established, then Buddhists from other areas are trying to find properties nearby the monastery so they can live and work there and have the monastery as the sort of the focus of their spiritual life. So, if you're ever up in like San Francisco or some of the drive up and just to, as an idea, to get some ideas for your own communities here and try to adapt something. If you've got friends and people, it's finding people, like-minded people are interested in something like this. And, yeah, it's a matter of working with what you've got here as well, and this is the monastery, and I find very inspiring. The monks have been there in it's about an hour east of Portland. It's strictly speaking, it's in Washington State, but all your access is from Oregon. Two monks from our tradition who had been living in Northern California went there 2-3 years ago. There is a strong supportive group in Portland. Monks can only go somewhere they're invited. But the monks said, we don't want any lay attendants. We just want to go as two monks. This is a big thing in our tradition because we're not allowed to touch any food that hasn't been put into our hands. We can't store food overnight. We can't grow our own food. So Buddhist monks are pretty well helped. We can't use money. Okay. So for 2 months to say we're going to go off and live in the in a town where there are no Thai Buddhists, no Asian Buddhists, no support structure, just the two of us. That's quite a brave thing. And what they did was, their lay supporters rented them a property on the top of a mountain. And every morning they walked 2,000 feet down into the town on arms round with their bowls, just like we do in Thailand. And then take whatever food was offered and then walk 2,000 feet back up again. So it's like quite, and people were just so impressed by that. You know, there's no proselytizing, there's no anything. It's just people say, wow, that's really something. And now, 3 years down, you know, I was just there and walking on arms around, and, you know, you could stop off in somebody's house, go into the chiropractors, go into the local coffee shop, and everyone's like, good morning, and they're all waiting for you with some food, and people just really enjoy giving. And I don't think a two-hour walk from the monastery, they've moved down a bit from the top of the mountain, but it's still a long walk, two-hour walk. And there wasn't a single motorist who didn't put up their hand. And kids going to school, they see the monks, and they said, everybody's waving. And I said, wow, that's incredible. Like Buddhist monks from dressed like this, completely integrated into not a cosmopolitan community by, you know, 98% white, you know, American culture, you know. So, and now, as I say, people are starting to move there and go there more often. So, and in Thailand, we do something called Tudong, where we just set off from our monastery with our bowl and our robes and walk, and walk through the mountains and the forests. But we have to camp for the night. We have these little umbrellas with you put up a rope between two trees, and you have an umbrella with a little hook on it, and you suspend the umbrella, and then there's a mosquito net comes down. That's how you spend your night. So and then in the morning, walk into a village, receive some food, and then carry on walking. So this is part of my tradition. There have just been two monks who did that, walking from North California to Portland. Like 600 miles took them two months of walking. And there was only 2 days that they weren't offered enough food to feed themselves for their daily walking. So, you know, sometimes we can feel that society is very harsh and selfish, but there's just this incredible amount of goodness and kindness and generosity out there, you know, if you're creating forms in which that can be expressed. You're welcome. So maybe one more question, and then.
Oh, hello. Yeah. I got two questions for you. first question that you talk about enlightenment level, they were like stream entry and yeah. Arahantship. How do you know that? What level are you on? My second question is about free will. These days, science can predict like how long you will, you know, like when if you get sick or cancer, they can tell how many more minutes you will die, you know, or live. And based on that, do we have free will at all? Because it seems like they can tell, you know, that you can live for 10 more minutes, you know. And those are my two questions. Thank you.
Each of those questions, you know, is about an hour to answer. So I'll try to be very short. One of the themes running through meditation communities of all spiritual traditions is overestimation of spiritual attainment. And when you developed very strong meditation, the negative mental states are suppressed to such a degree, and a sense of well-being and bliss and positive mental states is so strong and so constant that it's very common for meditators at that level to assume that they've reached one state of meditation. That's why it's in monastic traditions like mine, there are great enlightened teachers, and that's one of their one of the ways they give to the monastic community. Someone who believes that they've attained something will go to one of these teachers and ask. And often they will have psychic powers, but even not without psychic powers, they're able to tell by certain questions and certain procedures whether or not that's actually happened. So without going too much into that, we say that it's difficult to know, and that it's common for people to overestimate their attainment. My teacher Ajahn Chah had one of his key teachings is my nair, which means like it's not sure. And so he said, this is your greatest teacher. So whenever, you know, when you're happy, it's not sure. I mean, it can change in time. It's unpredictable. It's when you're unhappy, it's my nair. And he said, this becomes really important. When you think you're a stream enterer, he said, never forget my nair. When you think you're a once returner and on returner, even if you think you're an arahant, always, he said, bow to the my nair. So you don't have to, you know, you don't have to have a brand or a, you know, you don't have to decide on this. You know, what you do need to know is the state of your mind and whether or not there is any defilement in the mind. One of the most inspiring Dhamma talks, printed Dhamma talks, is given by Ajahn Mahabhu, Ajahn Jeff at Wat Metar, I think, was the one who translated this talk. And it refers, Ajahn Mahabhu, it's one of the few of the great monks who was willing to talk about these things in more public situation. And he'd reached the third level of enlightenment. And yet he was determined to put it to the test. And so his mind was just this bright, constantly bright, and this was a constantly bright state, let's say. And so he was aware, if that is not the enlightened state, then it must be a conditioned state. And that then it must be subject to arising and passing away. So he managed to sustain attention on that bright state for hour after hour after hour after hour, until there was just the slightest, most out of just little flicker. And then he knew that it wasn't the fully enlightened state. So that gives you some idea of the subtlety involved. The second question about free will, I'll give you a story from Ramana Maharshi. So not a Buddhist teacher, but one whose teaching is very similar. And he gave us an analogy of two friends living on a desert island, so completely separated from any kind of knowledge of the modern world, and a radio washes up from a shipwreck, and miraculously, in working order, they turn on the radio and there's the sound of a woman singing. And they have an argument about whether the woman in the little box can sing what she likes or she has to sing what she's told to sing. So that's the analogy of free will. You know, it's assuming, a woman in the box. And the Buddha says, can you find that little woman in the radio, or can you find this self who has self-will, who has freedom or does not have freedom of will? He said that the practice of meditation and of mindfulness creates a wedge between impulse and reaction. So you're going, or to put it another way, you're training, you're educating the mind to go from reaction to response, to wise response. So you have mindfulness creates a space, and that's the space in which you can make wise judgments, right, wrong, good, bad, helpful, unhelpful, and so on. So we, let's say we have a capacity which we can train and expand in which to free ourselves from blind reaction to stimulus through eyes, ears, nose, tongue, body, and mind. So without getting into, you know, metaphysics about these old, you know, chestnuts of Western philosophy about free will and determinism, what we can experience is that the more mindful we are, the more we are able to make wise choices. So I would like to end the session here because I have other commitments, and thank you for being such an attentive audience.
It's the end of session, so I gotta give a quick announcements and quick appreciations. And now I would like to ask Vicky to give some few words and Dr. William Chu to give some few words as a university and as a representative of organizer to make it happen today.
My name is Peggy, and I have pleasure to organize this Dharma talk by Tan Ajahn Chijasaro. It's very, very pleasure, you know, that is valuable to all of us and to me, and see all of you to come, and it make me and very, you know, happy, and that is more than anything else. And thank you to the organization and of the University of the West that let us use the facility to make this event happen. And thank you to Dr. Chu and Arun that is helped to organize this event. And again, thank you so much for all of you that come today.
I'm asking you to give an impromptu speech once again. I just want to use this opportunity to tell Venerable Ajahn Chijasaro how much we appreciate the inspiring, uplifting lessons you have shared with us. And on behalf of University of the West, I thank you. I thank everyone, Peggy, Arun, and volunteers involved. Please come back, and often too.
So I'd just like to offer a blessing that may the sun never set on the University of the West. And before I go, I want to tell you a story. I think you probably like stories. Thai people always ask me to tell stories. So this is a Japanese story. And there was an old lady, the grandmother, and she was a miserable, grumpy old lady. She had one area of happiness and light in her life, and that was her grandson. And she was overjoyed to find that her grandson had a gift for calligraphy. I was walking here, I saw the calligraphy on the wall. So this is, and she really wanted her son to be able to, her grandson, to be able to use his gift for calligraphy to make a living for himself and to grow in the world. But she was a poor old lady in the village, and what could she do to further her grandson's ambitions? She remembered that she had a distant relative, a monk, living in a nearby town, and he had something of a reputation as a calligrapher. So she took her grandson to see him, And she said, my grandson is so gifted, I think that he deserves study in the great calligraphy college in Tokyo. But I don't have the funds and the background to be able to send him there. Would you write a letter of recommendation for him to help? And the monk said, yes, of course. But then to the old lady's horror, instead of reaching for one of his beautiful, elegant calligraphy pens, he took an old pencil off the desk and just sharpened it with a knife and then wrote on a piece of paper, put in an envelope, and said, give this to the rector of the college, the calligraphy college in Tokyo, and I hope that will help you. She was boiling inside. She was so angry, but, you know, given the conventions at the time, she couldn't express this, but how could he be so heartless and be so dismissive of her and her grandson? All those beautiful pens there, and he just couldn't be bothered to use a proper pen, use an old pencil. So she was heartbroken and angry. But when she got home, she thought, well, you know, better give it a try anyway, who knows. So she took her grandson to to Tokyo and went to the college, and in a very tense and anxious way, she kind of embarrassed, she gave him this letter. He opened up and he looked at this letter and he said, if the author of this letter recommends this young man, I will take him for sure. She was absolutely dumbfounded. She didn't know whether to laugh or cry or whatever. But she eventually took leave of her grandson, left him at the college, and went home. Now, this old lady's reputation was just, you know, nobody wanted to go near her. You know, she's such a miserable, prickly old lady. But suddenly, over the course of time, things started to change. And people started to go around to help out in the house or to borrow things or for a discussion, or ladies with some marital problems or something. And her life changed so much that when a niece came to visit her, she said, what's going on? You seem so different. And how is it there are always people around the house when before I came, there was never anybody here except for your grandson? She said, something very, very profound happened to me. She said, I took my grandson to the monk to ask for a letter of recommendation. He wouldn't use a beautiful pen. He used this old pencil. And yet the greatest calligraphy master in the country took one look at it and took my grandson there and then. And you know, I went home on the on the bus and I was thinking about it, and it suddenly came to me, I'm that old pencil. I'm a blunt old pencil. And I've just always thought I had nothing to offer anybody, just a miserable little old pencil. And if I was to sharpen myself, just as that monk sharpened his pencil, maybe I could write something beautiful in what remains of my life. And that's what I've tried to do. So, thank you.